category design has worked in large companies. It's worked in startups. It's worked in nonprofits. It's worked in totally lowercase e entrepreneurs who are not trying to build a company, but have a great solopreneur gig. Like, it has been the thing that, one of the things I'm the most grateful for, because it has allowed me to be me and not be, have to be somebody else. I feel like I am at the peak of my creative powers and the most successful I've been in the business front.
Welcome to Centricity, the go-to podcast for B2B executives, designed to equip you with deep insights into your buyer's needs so you can consistently deliver exceptional value and generate transformational results with greater efficiency. In today's episode, our host, Will Riley, meets with Eddie Yoon to talk about unlocking greater market share through category design. If this is your first time listening, we're so glad you're here, and we hope you enjoy the episode. If you're a regular listener back for more valuable insights, we encourage you to leave us a rating and review. Now, let's dive in.
Eddie, thank you so much for coming on the Centricity podcast today. For our listeners out there, we have an exceptional guest, Eddie Yoon. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Will, for having me on. Super psyched to be here.
Absolutely. Well, guys, if you don't know who Eddie is, he's advised some of the nation's top companies in business strategy and growth strategy. He's a distinguished author. He's written two books, Super Consumers and the 22 Laws of Category Design. We're going to be unpacking a few of those today. So really excited to learn more there. And has also contributed extensively to the Harvard Business Review HBR on category strategy. So Eddie has advised companies from solopreneur startup all the way to Fortune 500 companies and has something to share for everyone. So Eddie, thanks so much again for joining us today. So how's your week been so far? Is this your 30th one of these, or how do you spend your weeks these days?
It's been great. So I do a fair amount of these for sure. Have been doing a lot of writing, and that's been super fun. And the joy that I get from writing, be it journaling about my business or about business in general, to writing articles for Category Pirates or for HBR, or frankly, I have a business that I'm part of, Jeneo, which is a medical facial company, writing to the field to encourage them about, you know, what I call weird data about the consumer and kind of where the market is headed. So all that's been super fun, and it's been, I love this stage of my career, and I'm very happy with it. So grateful.
Yeah. I love it. Well, and to that point, I know the listeners that maybe haven't read the book, I'd love to spend a good bit of this interview talking about category design, and would love if, for people who aren't necessarily well-versed in that, could you break that down for us?
Yeah, sure. Category design is what we call the ultimate strategy. So if you think about, there are probably 60,000 books on strategy on Amazon, so there's a lot that's been written about it, but really there's three types of strategies that are unique at its core. The first is what I call be the winner, right? So Will, it's competitive strategy. For me to win, you have to lose. All zero sum. And, you know,
right.
The part that's really interesting is that the majority of kind of the traditional strategy thinking is in this camp, which is kind of interesting to me, in that one of the most famous books on strategy is by Michael Porter called Competitive Strategy. And it's all five forces and, you know, it's either you're beating up on competitors, you're screwing the consumer, or you're squeezing your suppliers, and that's how you win at the end of the day. And that it's kind of striking to me that the vast majority of companies, when they think of strategy, that's what they think of. So that's kind of bucket one, and I would say 90% of companies fall into that bucket. Bucket two is what I call be the best. And so it might be an R&D or product or innovation strategy, right? I have the best, you know, chip, and that was Intel in the back in the day, and it's NVIDIA now, right? I have the best tasting food. I have the best manufacturing process. I have the best widget, whatever it might be. And, you know, that's also a great strategy. It can often lead to growing the pie, which is a good thing, right? So if you make an amazing product that has really kind of pushed the limit on what was deemed the best beforehand, you can charge more for it. You might bring in new customers to the category. You might drive more usage, and all those things are great. About 9% of companies fall into that bucket. The most rare strategy is what we call be different. So be the winner, be the best, be different. And that's where category design lies. And that whole premise is You're not competing against a competitor. You're not competing against the past version of the product. You're competing against just the status quo is really what it is that the status quo of the category writ large, if that makes any sense, which is to say, when Netflix talks about their competition, they say, we compete against boredom. It's not against HBO or Max or Hulu or, you know, whatever it might be. It's
right.
Yeah. It's like their whole mission is kind of the green eggs and ham, whether you're on a train, plane, or wherever, I want you to be watching Netflix. And that kind of drives their whole mode. And that when you know that they're serious when they created the binge watching category, which was radically different as a strategy, meaning, you know, and to this day, well, this is what I find so fascinating is that no one really does this still, which is when they launch a show, they launch all the episodes at once.
Right.
Because they, you know, want you to binge it. They want you to consume it all in one weekend. And everybody else is like, no. I put all this investment into, I want you to stick around for as long as possible so I can charge you that monthly fee. And so that whole kind of be different applies to what we call the magic triangle, the product, the company, and the category writ large. And that most people are not kind of aware that they have the opportunity and the permission to redesign what people thought of. And the kicker is that companies that do this, they grow revenue 4 times faster and market cap 6x higher. And so it's an incredibly lucrative strategy, and it kind of boggles the mind why people don't do it, but largely because it's a matter of risk tolerance. It's like, if we're in the coffee business, well, it's way easier to say, my coffee is better, faster, cheaper. Or I could right. say, no, I'm illy. I have the best coffee out there, but very few people want to be Starbucks or Keurig and say, this is a totally different way of having it.
Yeah. And it sounds like, to your point, it's if you don't want to be as successful as some of those examples, I mean, you don't necessarily have to. I mean, if 90% are in these other two buckets, or 99% rather, and we're talking about this 1%, then you're really tasked, whether you're a startup or maybe one of the, you know, Fortune examples, you know, pick a number on that list, is that if you don't want to break through and be that kind of industry thought market leader, then, you know, is category designed for them, or is it only for those people that are looking to be, you know, innovative and different? It sounds like it might be more on that side, people that are wanting to really change the game, right? And not every business out there wants to aspire to do that.
Well, you know, it's funny how you're getting at is oftentimes the nuance between an entrepreneur founder and an executive who, quote, inherits a business. Like one of the things that I will often tell people is that when I started my career, you would look up to these Fortune 500 executives and companies, and then you're like, oh, that's the pinnacle of business and this and that. But then you kind of look at, like, GE was thought to be this kind of company that you would look up to, and it's largely fallen apart now because it was like, well, their whole strategy, be number one or number two in the industry, was about competition, and it was about zero sum. And at the end of the day, the most innovative thing that they did was, you know, create GE Capital and their financing arm. And it was like, ah, that's how they were driving earnings per share so consistently year after year. It wasn't really anything about the core business. And so,
right.
And so you have kind of these, you know, this kind of like myth busting that's going on now, where you realize that the executives that run the largest companies did not found them. And they are what I call trust fund CEOs, so to speak, right? Like, they inherited it from somebody else. And it's just a different mindset when you build something from the scratch, and that most of the people who are practicing category design, they're not necessarily that they're the most innovative in their thinking, but they're often what I call super consumers of their own category. Like, they eat their own dog food and they care deeply about the product in a way that somebody who just is running a business to just get a job is not going to. And that most of the people who do this are, there's an emotional level of involvement, Will, where they're angry at the world as it is, because it could be so much better if we just designed it differently, right? And that's, I think, the nuance is that passion level. When, you know, Steve Demos, who was the founder of White Wave, which created Silk, you know, kind of the soy milk and the almond milk and oat milk and all that kind of stuff, right? He was a missionary. He was a pirate. He was angry at the dairy industry. He was just like, dairy is bad. Big old circle with a line through it, and plants are the future. And they believe that to the core of their being. And you can feel that as they go out and kind of market and sell and, you know, recruit and everything else. And so, like, why you have someone like Elon Musk, who has open sourced all of the Tesla patents. It's not a money-making venture. It's like he is a missionary. He wants to, the whole purpose of Tesla is to accelerate the world to sustainable energy. And it's not about making cars, and that you just run the business differently when you think kind of like, I am angry at the way of the world as it is. There's a future that's abundant, and I'm trying to get there as quickly as I can. And the more the merrier, right? That's kind of the way that they think. And it's a very different mindset, because I think the world is generally trained, whether in business or there's only one winner of the Super Bowl. The Texas Rangers won the World Series, right? There's only one winner there. And in business, it doesn't have to be that way.
As data compliance laws become more stringent, many organizations will soon have non-compliant CRM data. Maybe you have insufficient first-party data, or you bought information from an improperly validated third party. However, you got it. Fixing it before the 2023 deadline should be a top priority. FitzMartin's Wake the Dead program takes dead CRM prospects and applies a behavioral science model to re-engage them into your pipeline. In this process, you can reclaim old prospects or delete old ones, giving you a clean and compliant database with new opportunities from previously forgotten contacts. By retargeting with email and text automation, clients you might have considered dead or unresponsive will move forward and become potential prospects once again. For more information, check out the show notes or visit FitzMartin.com.
I'm curious in some of the examples and illustrations for maybe listeners are not in manufacturing or product development. How does this work whenever we're selling insurance or any kind of service or, you know, a new credit card or whatever that may be? Does this still apply in really all aspects of business, or do we see it really work well when it's manufacturing, assembly line, things like that?
Oh, great question. I have never not seen it work, you know, and really. We'll take some of the examples that you gave, like around the credit card. And it's fascinating because on the one hand, credit cards are, you might, oh, it's a commodity and, you know, what's different? Maybe you get more points and miles and this and that with it from one versus the other. But, you know, what was really kind of striking to me was, what is the credit card other than it's at the highest level, it's an extension of credit. Hey, Will, I know you're good for the money. You can buy it. And you can pay it a month later. That's essentially what the whole category is, right? And that when you think about, you know, what that means is it's the ability to extend credit is one thing. And, you know, and it's just a cash flow thing. But then the innovation on that was the reward space, right? It's like, well, maybe I'll give you a Scooby snack if you do this or that. And that's kind of a good thing. And then it's gotten to the point where, if you remember during COVID, the airlines like United, American, and Delta all had to get major loans because nobody was flying, so they had to survive. And what was the most valuable part of their business? It was the frequent flyer program. And in fact, when you kind of dug underneath it, they were able to, quote, mortgage those programs to get great amounts of debt to keep afloat. But when you looked at the numbers, it was like, it's way more profitable to be in the frequent flyer business than to be in the airline business. And that in many respects, they created a currency. And that this is the whole kind of idea of categories, new categories beget categories. So somebody invented the credit card. And then from there, somebody invented the rewards program. And from there, American Airlines, with the creation of the, you know, Advantage program, was the first loyalty program that had ever been created. And, you know, forget all this talk about crypto. Frequent flyer miles are a currency. You can buy and exchange them for airplane tickets. You can buy and exchange them for Taylor Swift concert tickets, apparently, and the like, right? I mean, and it's, you know, these are things that we say new categories beget new categories. But the other part, Will, that's really, really important is that, again, we want to lower the bar for folks that don't feel intimidated by this. Because, you know, whether insurance or whatever, it doesn't matter the sector that you're in, is that here's the aha, is that today's solutions become tomorrow's problems. And that all category design is the identification of a problem and bringing an entirely new to the world solution for it. So if you look at my Apple Watch, new category, smartwatches, all that, but it exists because of the iPhone, also a new category, right? And part of the reason why the smartwatch, the Apple Watch exists is I was looking at my darn iPhone too much. And so they're trying to create some distance for you. So it's like, wait a minute, Apple, you're trying to get me to buy something because I used something else that you sold me too much. Is that really what's going on? And yesterday's solutions become today's problems, which become tomorrow's solutions with that. And that whole kind of mindset is that whether it is, so take insurance as an example, right? So you got homeowners insurance, you got life insurance, you got auto insurance, you got all kinds of insurance, right? There's something called final expense insurance. I don't know if you're familiar with that category. And it's, you know, it's kind of dour and, you know, it's kind of a sad thing to think about, but it's, you got somebody in your family who may be sick or whatever, you don't have money for the funeral. So it is a mini, mini life insurance policy, which, you know, but it's much shorter in duration and you can, you know, it can be expensive, but, you know, if you need 10 grand for a funeral, it's gotcha. It's one of the fastest growing sectors in all of insurance. Now, somebody might say, that's not new. It's just shorter life insurance. But, you know, in the same way that coffee as a caffeine delivery is not new, it's been around for centuries and ages, as energy drinks, it's new. Is it new? Or is it another mechanism for caffeine delivery? Is 5-hour energy new?
New category.
Yes, it's another. Yeah, but they're different niche problems for what you can deliver. And that final expense is the same thing. It's like, hey, people don't think about life insurance because they don't want to think about death and it's far away, but I got a problem here and now. I got to provide for my parents' funeral. I don't have the funds for it. Here's an easy way to hedge against it. And it's a deeply emotionally rich product to offer. And it makes people's lives meaningfully better in a horrible time so that they don't have to worry about all of that. So like, I have never not seen category design work. And that's the part that I think is so exciting, is that if you can spot a problem, you have category design. And if you can't spot a problem, spot a solution that's working extremely well and know that that'll become a problem. So GLP-1s, Ozempic and, you know, Mounjaro and all those things. Why do they exist? Foods become super cheap and accessible. That's the problem with it, right? Well, why did that exist? Well, because, you know, we had food deserts and we had, you know, we needed to be able to safely transport food. Why did canned food and that kind of processed food, why was that created? Because people were dying from E. coli back in the day, right? Yeah. Like it was just like
food safety
was a massive problem. But Campbell's was the greatest, one of the great tech innovations in the 1800s. Where have they, but they've forgotten their mantle of innovation and they were saving lives 100 years ago. What are they doing now, right? And this is the whole thing of like, and guess what? With Ozempic and GLP-1s, great solution, going to create a problem that someone else can solve with it. You just got to follow the thread.
Well, and yeah, when you start getting into shortages of compounding and, you know, all the independent pharmacy thing, now you're creating this other awareness gap of, well, how do I get it and who do I need it? And, you know, all those things. So we have a few clients that are in that industry. And as you were talking, I'm thinking of, yeah, we're writing content right now that hopefully might be that new category add-on that is created through these shortages that we're seeing in Ozempic and other semaglutide related products. So it's like literally as you're talking, I'm like, I get it. Totally get it. Well, and if you say that it's never not worked, how did you discover this in business? Was it you kept seeing this commonality among businesses and then you nailed it one day? Or was it more of a gap and then you wrote about it and then kind of stumbled? Because I think a lot of your examples are hundreds of years old or in the last couple of years or 6 to 9 months with semaglutide. So I'm curious of when did you just have that aha moment for it?
I got lucky in that. So I was a senior partner at the Cambridge Group for 18 years and we did a ton of growth strategy work for some of the largest consumer companies out there. And consulting is a bit of a random walk. Like you never know what you're going to get staffed on when you're a young consultant. And you know, I got put on these massive market leader clients. So Anheuser-Busch had a 48 share of beer in the US. Gillette had a 70 share of shaving worldwide. The record, I think, was InSinkErator. They make garbage disposals. They have a 93 share of garbage disposals in the US.
Lucky to be them.
Yeah, right. So here's the challenge is lucky to be them, but yesterday's solutions become tomorrow's problems. How do you grow a business like that, right? Because getting that 94th share point is really hard and really expensive. And so it began to emerge for me was basically all the previous business training, I just had to throw out because most of it is be the winner. Take share, take share, take share, right? And I can't do that in these scenarios where they have a dominant market share. So the only way to grow was you had to grow the category, which meant one of three things. I got to add new consumers to the category. I got to add more units per consumer. I got to add more higher price per unit, right? And so like coffee, I've done a lot of work in and that comes back to it, right? So, you know, Starbucks is a far bigger dairy company than they are a coffee company. And you can make the argument they're not really a coffee company. They're a milkshake company, really, really at the core, right? And so why is that important?
Yeah, I'm a coffee snob and my, you know, when my coworkers order the pumpkin spice latte, I was like, where's the coffee in there?
So you're speaking my language. Yep. I'm a black coffee drinker and I like my beans 100%. The way they are and stuff.
So I get a quad when I go out.
There you go. Okay. We see each other very, very plainly here, right? And so that's the beauty of it is that how do you get coffee is not a pleasant thing for people to drink the first time. It is an acquired taste. Most people have to doctor it with sugar and cream and everything else. How do you get more people into it? You don't make it coffee anymore. It's, you know, it's a whole lot more milk and other stuff, right? And so they added new people. And then, you know, Starbucks is the queen of category design within coffee of how do you get more units per person? Like, how do you get people to drink more caffeine in a, you know, caffeine, you can get caffeine poisoning. I have seen it happen to some people and stuff. And so, Frappuccino, it's cold. When do you drink it? In the afternoon, right? And it's like, oh, okay. Milkshake in the morning, milkshake in the afternoon. Everybody's happy with that, right? And then the genius of their strategy is their ability to charge more and more for per cup of coffee. And what is hilarious to me is like, it's the, well, this is a special blend from this part of Africa and this and that. But your point is like, but isn't it 90% milk? And is the milk any different than what it is, right? So like their ability to premiumize the price based on very little coffee itself is quite remarkable. So you have this kind of, so for me, what they did was what I had to learn how to do for my clients at a dominant market share. And then that eventually led me to, I developed a spike in an expertise there. And then, you know, clients started to find me of American Girl and Keurig and iRobot, which was like, we have this new thing. Nobody knows how big it is. And so for Keurig, when I did work with them from 2011 to 2014, they grew from about $1 billion to $4.5 billion in that time. And it was crazy. And it was so controversial because David Einhorn, big hedge fund guy, was shorting them. It was like, it's a hill of beans, no pun intended. And then like, you know, you had other people that were super bullish on it. And the problem with new categories is nobody knows the size of prize. How high is high? And that became a specialty of mine, was really kind of digging into understanding like, how big is the problem that you're solving for? And then market sizing it from there. And that was super important, Will, because like their problem was they were chronically underinvesting in the business. So everybody was pissed at them because they were out of brewers, they were out of K-cups. And in part, a new line of K-cups cost $5 million and took 9 months to build. So you had to be thoughtful and you didn't want to get out over your skis until we did the work that said, this is going to be in 1 in 3 households. Like, don't worry about it. Like, if you're going to be wrong on the overinvestment side. And now where they are now, they want to be wrong on the other side because they've gotten the 30 million households, which is what I predicted that they would get to, you know, 10 years ago or so. But yeah, it became a specialty. And then of mine, it was super fun. I started writing about it. And it's one of those things where when you get hooked on a category design thing, you never want to go back because
The
trick of consulting is most consulting firms, they stick to big companies because they have the biggest budgets.
Right.
But those are the least interesting problems to solve from a growth perspective. So
when you're implementing, do you find companies starting to implement category design, they're looking for that growth? So that's, you know, if you need to get to 10X, 5X, whatever the multiplier is, are those signals for a company that, hey, if you're not doing it now, and you probably are one of the 99%, especially if you've never heard of it before, you're almost certainly not using it. So I'm curious on who's the first to implement and what does that look like to implement, even if you maybe aren't looking for growth, depending on how you answer that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I would say that there's a few types of category designers. There's the accidental category designer, and I help a lot of those people, which is we created something, it's growing really fast. We have no idea why. And how do we ride and stay on this bucking bronco, right? Like that's a big one that a lot of them do. And so one of my business partners, now Clint Carnell, is a serial category creator. And he was the CEO of Hydrafacial when it went from 40 million in sales to now they're going to be about 600 million in sales. But took them out public at $1.1 billion, traded up to $4.5 billion. But like that whole thing was like, this is growing super fast. You know, his board was upset with him because he kept blowing by his budget and his numbers. And they were like, you're sandbagging. He's like, no, it's just, we don't know how high is high. And so you have those kind of folks. And, you know, Clint and team were excellent at just like, oh, category design explains why we are successful. And therefore, we should double down on these things and avoid these other things, right? And that when you put a conventional strategy on a category creator, it just does not work. It tends to blow up the business, actually. So you have the accidental ones. You have some folks that are serial category designers. And that's, you know, so this is the difference between Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, right? No one's denying that Facebook Meta is an amazing category creating business. However, he has only done it once. And it is not entirely clear that he knows why he was successful. Meaning,
right.
He launches Threads, right? It's supposed to be the big Twitter killer and everything else. And, you know, people were like, oh, you know, Twitter's going to die. And lo and behold, it launched to, because they have a tremendous amount of distribution. It's not clear that there's any real conversation or activity going on there now. X is still X. And that.
Yeah, outside of the fastest growing download of an app, which is an amazing day 7 stat. But now here we are in November. You're right. I mean, what's activity look like?
And, right? You know, the part that is so fascinating to me is that we took a look at Zuck's social media activity on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. And when he launched Threads in the next, I forget, 4 to 6 months afterwards, it was like, he's posting more about his MMA activity than he is about Threads. And frankly, he's posting more about his like shirtless and, you know, tournaments and things that he's, you know, rolling on the floor with all these, which is amazing. But he's talking about that more than he is Threads, more than he is the metaverse. So it begs the question, does he really care about Threads, right? You know, your treasure is where your heart is. And that when Elon, whatever you like him or hate him, like, you know, he cares about what he launches. It is an existential crisis for him. It is a mission for him. And I think that's that kind of missionary mercenary distinction is the difference between a serial category creator, you know, Tesla, SpaceX, Neuralink, the Boring Company, you know, I'm forgetting a whole bunch, right? And somebody who's done it once. And even you look at Larry and Sergey at Google, like they're not even in the game. They're not doing anything on the business front. They're just kind of enjoying what they have. So is Bezos, right? So
I love it. Well, this has been such an incredible conversation. And I'm really curious just to kind of hit that home. I mean, what if I'm listening and I want to get started? Do I need to buy the book? Do I need to call you, message you on LinkedIn? Just how do I begin this? If I haven't stumbled upon it, maybe I'm not serial, but I'm interested in learning more.
Yeah, no, the best way is there's a ton of it that's been written about for free. Go to HBR. We've written about it a ton there. Find us on socials, as you said, Eddie Wood Grow at Twitter. And then you can find me on LinkedIn. There's a bunch of stuff that's posted there. But yeah, 22 Laws of Category Design is probably the most comprehensive way to pick it up. Like Play Bigger was the original book that my business partner, Christopher Lockett and friends published. That is the great, you know, starting place. 22 Laws kind of picks it up and combines that with my super consumers work into kind of what I think the latest thinking is on. And then our Category Pirate Substack is, we got 27,000 people learning about category design all the time with that. So it is what I love about it, Will, is that it's a never ever evolving field, in that I am confident in my skill set there, but I'm also confident that I'm never going to not be learning from others and, you know, different businesses around it. And it is so exciting. Like, I will tell you that category design has worked in large companies. It's worked in startups. It's worked in nonprofits. It's worked in totally lowercase e entrepreneurs who are not trying to build a company, but have a great solopreneur gig. Like, it is been the thing that I am one of the things I'm the most grateful for, because it has allowed me to be me and not have to be somebody else and kind of live. I feel like I am at the peak of my creative powers and the most successful I've been in the business front. And that, you know, kind of part of my mission is, you know, my category buddy, Christopher Lockett, says, you know, when you get up to the top, throw down a rope for other people. Like, it's so transformational. Our goal is to try to raise 100,000 category designers in the next X years. And if we do that, the world will be a better place.
I love it. Well, for listeners, Eddie, that want to keep up with you personally? How can they keep up with you and all the great things that you're doing to hopefully hit that 100,000 number?
Yeah, certainly on Twitter at Eddie Wood Grow, or email me eddie@eddiewoodgrow.com, and you know, happy to connect with anybody who wants to join the journey. There's lots of avenues and ways. And part of what Christopher and I are trying to do is digitize ourselves so that we can help the most amount of people, because, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. But whether through our writing, through our videos and podcasts, or through the, we launched a Category Design Academy on Mighty Networks. Like, we're just trying to figure out ways to make technology our friend and scale so that as many people as possible can benefit from it. So.
That's amazing. Well, Eddie, thank you again for joining us on Centricity today, and look forward to that journey.
Thanks, Will, for having me.
We sure appreciate you listening today. If you would like to get in contact with today's guest or stay in touch with us, visit our show notes. Additionally, to get the latest strategies for the alignment between marketing and sales, visit fitzmartin.com. As a reminder, if you have found value in today's episode, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, or your favorite podcast directory. Until next time, thanks for listening.